Blog Talk Radio.
Paperback Writer.
This is the Writer's Lounge show number 136. The date today is April 3rd, 2023, and I am your host, Tom Riedel. Tonight, Terry has the night off, and brief intro to today's show, we have the George stories on, and the author would be Christopher Gould. And Chris will be with us about 15 minutes after the hour, so stand by for that. And now more about us. Here's where you can find us out there. Find us on Facebook, The Writer's Lounge, showcasing new authors. Find the book reviews of all of our current shows over at thomasriedel.net in the blog section. And the on-demand radio shows can be found there on the podcast page as well. Or go over to the Blog Talk Radio site and search for The Writer's Lounge. Or find us very easily on a Google search. Find me on Twitter at TomRiedel56, and our email is writerslounge2020@yahoo.com. If you want to be a guest on the show and have your book reviewed, put guest request in the subject line, and we will get back to you. A special note, we can now also be heard on your Alexa device. Subscribe to Apple Podcasts and ask her to play The Writer's Lounge, showcasing new authors. I'd also like to put in a plug for Goodreads and Readsy Discovery. They both do a great deal to help authors and readers alike, and I also review books on both sites as well. And upcoming authors on the Writer's Lounge, 2 weeks from tonight, author Suzette Lytle will be here with her book Desert Phoenix, at once a sweeping love story and a harrowing account of the hardships of American Old West. Desert Phoenix is the tale of a prostitute who gains an unlikely ally in her struggle for physical and emotional survival. This novel is based on family stories passed down from the author's grandfather. We look forward to learning more about this author and her book. And on May 1st, it's to be announced. We haven't filled that slot yet, so again, if you're an author out there and you want to be on the show, send us an email and we will get back to you on that. And we'll be letting you know as soon as we update that slot. And you can find us over on Facebook to find out more information on that. Again, that would be May 1st, 2023. In Writers Topics tonight, of course, we normally have Terry on. She's very knowledgeable about writing tools that we use in the Writers Topic, but she will not be here tonight and will be off and back here in 2 weeks. So we look forward to having her. We were going to talk about a subject that is very big these days in author and reader circles, and that would be the subject of book bans and censorship. It's also big in the messy world of politics, but we will discuss the subject on our next show, but we'll try to steer clear of the political circus and focus on the facts and the thoughts that we have as writers, and also, of course, through the lens of a reader. Filling in tonight will be a clip on how writers should show and not tell, and we're going to play that clip right now, and we'll be back to talk to Chris after it is complete.
The girl was scared of the wilderness, her heart pounding at every frightening noise. But suddenly her fear disappeared. She touched the ground, and it felt like her new guardian. What's wrong with this picture? Well, for one, this passage doesn't actually paint much of a picture, and it fails to make me feel anything as a reader. That's the core problem with writing that relies too much on telling. We're told the girl is scared, that the noises are frightening, and that this place feels like a guardian. Yet there isn't much evidence to back up those claims. Show, don't tell is a phrase you've probably heard often in the writing community. Author K.M. Weiland best captures the distinction. Showing dramatizes, telling summarizes. But it can be hard to identify harmful instances of telling in your own writing. Telling is not inherently bad. In fact, all novels are a blend of telling and showing. You don't always need to show instead of tell. If that were the case, all stories would be ridiculously long and filled with unnecessary descriptions. Telling is useful for quickly conveying the passage of time or presenting important facts to the reader without belaboring the point. Take a look at the opening of the children's novel, The Secret Garden, by Frances Hodgson Burnett.
When Mary Lennox was sent to Misselthwaite Manor to live with her uncle, everybody said she was the most disagreeable-looking child ever seen. It was true, too. She had a little thin face and a little thin body, thin light hair and a sour expression. Her hair was yellow, and her face was yellow, because she had been born in India and had always been ill in one way or another.
We're told some information about Mary being a disagreeable-looking child who's always been ill. But that statement is immediately supported by the visual proof of her thin face and hair, along with her sour expression. If someone flags your writing for too much telling, that likely means you need to provide details or a strong narrative voice to make the reader feel something. Good writing invites the reader to visualize the scene and experience the emotions themselves, rather than being told how to feel. In his TED Talk, The Clues to a Great Story, Pixar writer and director Andrew Stanton proposes the unifying theory of 2+2. He says, make the audience put things together. Don't give them 4, give them 2+2. The opening of relies entirely on showing the audience the equation without giving them the answer. And he describes why that approach is effective.
Storytelling without dialogue, it's the purest form of cinematic storytelling. It's the most inclusive approach you can take. It confirms something I really had a hunch on, is that the audience actually wants to work for their meal. They just don't want to know that they're doing that. That's your job as a storyteller, is to hide the fact that you're making them work for their meal. We're born problem solvers. We're compelled to deduce and to deduct, because that's what we do in real life. It's this well-organized absence of information that draws us in. There's a reason that we're all attracted to an infant or a puppy. It's not just that they're damn cute. It's because they can't completely express what they're thinking and what their intentions are. And it's like a magnet. We can't stop ourselves from wanting to complete the sentence and fill it in.
The same principle is true for other non-visual modes of storytelling. The key to making your audience care in fiction is to imply your meaning rather than always pointing it out. Readers love the process of discovery and solving puzzles. Before we dive into some practical strategies, I want to take a two-minute detour to explore the origins of Show Don't Tell as a writing mantra, since it's not often discussed. In his 2004 book, Creative Writing and the New Humanities, scholar Paul Dawson describes how the novel transformed across the 19th and 20th centuries with the rise of realism as a literary movement. Realism aims to tell the stories of ordinary people with complete honesty rather than romanticizing them. Dawson notes, from Flaubert onwards, the trajectory of the novel is often regarded as the development of techniques to impersonalize the narrator in order to efface the presence of the implied author and dramatize as much of the action as possible. Literary critic Percy Lubbock praised those 19th century realists for giving the novel a defined aesthetic, and it's his 1921 book, The Craft of Fiction, that likely popularized the idea of showing versus telling. He says, the art of fiction does not begin until the novelist thinks of his story as a matter to be shown, to be so exhibited that it will tell itself. Authors like Virginia Woolf both praised and criticized Lubbock for confining the novel writing craft to a formal system. His ideas were incredibly influential in the literary world. Basically, the intention of this advice is to turn the author into an invisible narrator and avoid breaking the reader's immersion in the story. Janice Hardy makes a similar observation in her 2016 writing guide, Understanding Show, Don't Tell. A common rule of thumb, as long as it feels like the character is thinking it, you're usually okay. But as soon as it sounds like the author butting in to explain things, you've probably fallen into telling. If you want readers to experience the story's emotions on a gut level, you've got to know when to show. Generally speaking, moments involving emotions, opinions, or sensations are best shown rather than told. Here are 6 guiding principles for a stronger showing. Number 1, use evidence to support your claims. If a narrator says her husband is a kind-hearted person, or the protagonist believes his best friend is guilty of murder, what led them to that conclusion? Give the reader the same evidence the character uses when it comes to assumptions or opinions. Author Chuck Pumpernickel advises a ban on thought verbs like thinks, knows, understands, realizes, believes, wants, remembers, and imagines. He talks about unpacking scenes so that the reader feels and thinks what the characters are feeling and thinking. He gives this example. Instead of saying, Adam knew Gwen liked him, you'll have to say, between classes, Gwen was always leaned on his locker when he'd go to open it. She'd roll her eyes and shove off with one foot, leaving a black heel mark on the painted metal, but she also loved the smell of her perfume. The combination lock would still be warm from her ass, and the next break, Gwen would be leaned there again. Polonique adds, instead of characters knowing anything, you must now present the details that allow the reader to know them. Instead of a character wanting something, you must now describe the thing so that the reader wants it. You can pull readers into the story by presenting evidence, whether that's a visual detail or a piece of dialogue, and letting them come to their own conclusions about the impression you're trying to create. Number 2, replace the abstract with the concrete. In particular, be careful about directly stating a character's feelings. The blog Novel Writing Help by Harvey Chapman gives a great before and after example. Telling, after his first kiss with Samantha, Toby walked home feeling happier than he'd ever felt in all his 13 years. Showing, after his first kiss with Samantha, Toby couldn't keep the goofy grin off his face all the way home. When he came to the front gate, he jumped clean over it, didn't come close to tripping. Chapman further explains why the changes work. Happiness is an abstract concept and needs to be demonstrated, shown, not told, with concrete details, like the wide grin and the gate jumping. So you can often replace emotions with actions that allow the reader to infer the emotion. Also be wary of descriptions that use opinion-related adjectives, like beautiful or strange. In a first draft, I might write, the dark forest felt eerie. Okay, maybe it feels eerie to the character, but the reader needs to feel it too. I need to convince the reader that it's eerie using evidence. The forest hummed with the cries of children long dead. That's better. Sufficiently eerie. Replace adjective labels with details that allow the reader to interpret the atmosphere on their own. A trick for identifying when you're in abstract territory is to ask a question that Jeff Gert poses in his book, The First 50 Pages. Can the camera see it? Almost all examples of showing contain a detail that can be visualized, although you'll often want to combine those visuals with smell, touch, taste, and sound. Author Jerry Jenkins provides great examples of replacing abstract emotions with concrete actions on his blog. Cold, don't tell me, show me. Your character pulls her collar up, tightens her scarf, shoves her hands deep into her pockets, turns her face away from the biting wind. Tired? He can yawn, groan, stretch. His eyes can look puffy. His shoulders could slump. Another character might say, didn't you sleep last night? You look shot. Another way of thinking about this camera idea is to consider the effect and not the cause of a particular detail. Take a look at these additional examples from Jerry Jenkins. Telling, the temperature fell and the ice reflected the sun. Showing, Bill's nose burned in the frigid air and he squinted against the sun reflecting off the street. Telling, Susie was blind. Showing, Susie felt for the bench with a white cane. Telling, it was late fall. Showing, leaves crunched beneath his feet. In the first example, the cold temperature is the cause of specific effects on the character, namely Bill's nose burning in the frigid air. Instead of being stated outright, the details are instead shown through how the character interacts with the world around them, like leaves crunching beneath their feet, which makes the scene more visual.
Okay, and I hope you enjoyed that. It's always a favorite here on the Writer's Lounge for writers who tune into this show. It's something that we all have to think about when we sit down to write our next novel, and I hope a lot of you are preparing to do that or are in the middle of doing that. So on to the next chapter of our show, which would be the guest author intro and interview. And, of course, Christopher Gould is here with the George Stories. And I want to remind everybody, if you're out there listening live, you should not be shy. Give us a call at area code 914-219-0868. And you can ask a question or a comment to our author tonight, which would be, I just dropped the name there, of course, but that would be Christopher Gould. So anyways, that would be the number that you call. Once again, it's area code 914-219-0868. And my review of the George Stories, George Martian is born into a world of normalcy, but he proved to be anything but normal. He is soon measured up to be a child prodigy, and his greatness is seen to have no boundaries. But then tragedy strikes, thrusting him in the complete opposite direction, causing him to be totally dependent on others for his survival. His family treats him as a burden, leaving George with no place to turn but to himself. With grit and determination, he manages to escape some of the turmoil, but his lot in life is still a constant and difficult struggle. Through the tragic and comical segments of his life, George searches for his own identity, place, and even though he is able to shake some of the negative chains off, he is still weighed down by them, and the thought of them will forever haunt him. The George Stories gives us a snippet of a man's life from childhood to adulthood, and in the way it is written, it allows us time to think about George and to also examine our own lives as compared to his. What we find, while most of us will, are a lot of similarities between him and us and how we internalize, analyze, and react to others and their behaviors towards us. In doing so, we become either silent or we speak up. But no matter the case, there are always consequences. Sometimes good, sometimes bad. While sometimes extreme, I could relate to George Martian, and I began to really like and care for the character. I was there with him, rooting him on as he faced his life. The author's style was to present George's life in sections of vignettes, which leaves the reader to use our imaginations to fill the gaps. This works, and sometimes it doesn't, depending on the personal preferences of the reader. For me, it worked, but I still wanted to learn more, which led me up to each segment of George's life. When I, as a reviewer, want more story from an author, it says a lot about the talent that the writer has, so I can't wait to read more from Christopher Gould. I love the George Stories. And now it is our pleasure, if Terry was here, and it is certainly my pleasure, to welcome Chris Gould to the Writer's Lounge broadcast. And as we say, it's a imaginary studio, and I'll reach over here and open up the door, and I'll let this gentleman in the studio here. And how are you doing, Chris?
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me on.
Very nice to have you here, and I can almost kind of reach out and almost touch you because we come to find out that you are a neighbor of mine living in the same area that I live here in Syracuse, New York, and it's amazing how that happens sometimes. With Terry, I would often kid her about forming new friendships because we would find somebody that was close to her in North Carolina. I think we had a writer on last time who lived in South Carolina, and here I find out that I have somebody on the show probably closest to what I've ever had, and you're probably within a couple of miles of where I live. So I want to say,
yeah,
hello, it's
a
neighbor.
Small world.
Yeah, I want to say hello, neighbor, and welcome to the broadcast. And starting out here, Chris, where did you start on your journey to becoming a writer and eventually a published author?
I think I was probably in my mid-20s where I started to get the writing bug, and over a period of time it became more and more important to me, and I ended up submitting some work. I took some creative writing classes, and then in 2013 I had my first short story accepted for publication.
Oh,
so that was really the start of it.
Wow. And did you have any aspirations of being a writer back when you were in grade school or high school?
You know, I didn't. I was always kind of a daydreamer. I probably still am to a certain extent, for better or worse. But I kind of wish I had gotten into it earlier, but I'm glad I did nonetheless.
Yeah, and you're also a teacher. And talk about daydreaming. I did a lot of that as a student in school, and it's kind of interesting that you would be a teacher daydreaming a lot. But we'll talk a little bit more about your teaching career as we go along.
Sure.
Here. But how did George begin in your mind, and what tools did you use to develop his character and the others in your story?
You know, that's a good question. I think initially I was writing a series of short stories, just sort of playing around with them, and after I had six or seven of them, roughly, I realized they were all really the same character. So it dawned on me they should probably all have the same name. So I eventually settled on the name George, and I started to put them together as a novel.
Uh-huh. And did he haunt your days and nights like a lot of us writers do? You know, like Terry talks about having them speak to you when you're ready to go to sleep, and you know, basically it stops you from sleeping, and you're up at all times of night. So how does that work for you? Does that happen to you?
Yeah, I think in my case, it took me roughly 10 years to write the George stories. So it was a long process, and I certainly spent a lot of time with George. And, yeah, so you would always sort of, you know, during your free moments, you might think of an idea or a character trait or a particular circumstance. So it was an ongoing thing for sure. I think if you're a writer and if you get into it, you do sort of start to have what they call like a writerly life, where you're always looking for new ideas, interesting storylines, and that type of thing. And I certainly fell into that category.
I think you write a lot the same way as I do. I don't normally sit down every day and write, but I do it in spurts. And I've basically working on a novel now that I started almost 15 years ago and still haven't completed it. I'm near the end of it, but I still haven't been able to put together a good ending. Maybe it's because those characters are not talking to me, and they better start talking because I'm not getting any younger here. And
right,
I'd like to get the story done. But it's interesting to hear different writers on the show here talk about how quickly they write or how slow they write. I know Terry is a lot like me. We're not hunkered down by some, you know, timeline or something that we have to, you know, constrain ourselves to, like writing for a certain number of hours each day. So it's more like,
sure,
when it hits us, we write it. So it, good for you for finally getting it done. It must have been exciting for you. Do you use outlines when you write, and how often do you write?
These days I write pretty much every day. I've been working on a newer project, but I typically like to just sort of see where it goes as I sit down and peck away, and then after that I'll go back and refine it accordingly. That's the general way. Obviously, things can change anytime down the line as you go back and rework pieces.
Do you have, like, for instance, when you sit down to write, do you know where a story is going to end, or does that just come with the progression of sitting down and write? As Terry likes to say, she writes by the seat of her pants. In other words,
right,
whatever comes along, you just go with the flow. It's like you're living the story yourself, where some authors will have to sometimes outline where the ending, or they know the ending, but they just have to get to it. Does that fit with your world?
It really depends. With the George stories, actually most of the chapters were written out of sequence. In fact, the ending was actually the second story in the whole novel that I had written. So I did know the ending from a pretty early stage with that particular piece. But it very much depends. My second novel that's going to be coming out relatively soon, that was more of a planning novel, and I didn't know the ending for a good long time.
Uh-huh. Good. And we just touched briefly on it. You are a teacher here in Central New York, and
yes,
there are struggles that George goes through that can relate to what kids are really feeling in the classroom. How do you identify problems like that, and what can you do to help a child learn and develop as they progress through the years?
I think in this day and age, it's definitely gotten more challenging. There are far more outside factors that as a teacher you have to take into consideration, whether it's home life or things that are available on the internet and that kind of thing. So you always sort of have to find the right and strike the right balance as an educator. In some cases, kids might come in hungry or might have some other circumstance that sort of makes their learning experience very much challenging.
Did that play into your story of George, adding your experiences as a teacher as it relates to your students?
No, I don't think so. I think a lot of my stuff and ideas, I'm inspired by other writers, other stories I've read, and I like the idea of somebody young with full of promise all of a sudden having their life be a shambles and see how they cope and move on from that. So I'm very much inspired by a million different authors and stories and that kind of thing, more so than daily life.
What subjects do you teach?
I am a high school special education teacher, actually.
Oh, okay. All right. And have you taught special ed through all of your years, or is that something that you kind of moved into?
No, I've been doing it for nearly 30 years.
Wow, good for
you.
Yeah. It must
Thank
be,
you.
It's got to be very rewarding, especially in
it
that
is.
Field.
It is, yeah, for sure, and I certainly work with great kids and great people.
Have you lived in the Syracuse area for a long time?
I grew up in a small town called Pulaski, New York.
I don't know
if you're familiar with that. That's my official hometown. I went to college in Rochester, Nazareth College, and I eventually found a teaching job here in the area in 1994, and I've been teaching here ever since.
I'm not sure if I saw it on your page when I was scrolling down your Facebook page, but a couple months ago you had mentioned something about, or you posted something that had relationships to do with writers groups in the area. Did you go to any like writers conferences or anything like that, say back in December?
I did some author appearances locally. There were a few in December, a few in the fall also.
Okay. All right.
It was just some local, yeah, I was invited to be on some panels and that kind of thing.
Uh-huh. Very good. I've, you know, written a couple books myself, and I would like to at some point maybe connect up with you, maybe in person.
Sure, absolutely, yeah.
Have a coffee or a chit-chat. It would be interesting to talk to you about your experiences as a writer. But unlike many first-time authors in the Writer's Lounge, you, as you had mentioned, you went to college in Rochester and earned a degree in writing. What benefited you most from going to college through the writing curriculum that other writers might not be aware of?
The program that I was a part of was actually a technical writing program, which is kind of an interesting background compared to more of the creative piece.
I see.
So it was just part of the program, and it worked out well. It was certainly valuable, but it gives you a different perspective.
And I noticed in your writing, the George stories, you are very descriptive in your writing. And I know in the beginning of the program, we were talking about show, don't tell. And I could picture everything in his life. And you did a fabulous job with description. It puts you in sort of a different category, do you think, than other writers? Are you focusing on that when you're writing your next book, or how does that play in your mind as a writer?
Yeah, I think I'm probably largely influenced by the writers that I like and enjoy and obsess over. For example, I think the George stories is probably very similar to like the work of like a James Thurber, like a third person outside perspective. And it sort of takes that kind of style. My next book is probably more mainstream. It's a college novel. But there are some similarities between the two though.
Can you share with us what your next book's going to be about? Do you have a working title yet?
Yeah. It's going to be out in, looks like, June. It's called The Boys and Girls of America. It's a college novel set in the 90s. It centers on a visiting writer in residence. His name is James Castle. He is at this college for a year, but as it turns out, this particular college was his dream school years ago, but he wasn't accepted. So he has a chance to go back and kind of see what he missed out on. And that's really just on the tip of the iceberg of it, but that's the basics of it.
Is the word count longer than George stories or shorter?
Substantially, yeah.
Substantially longer or shorter?
Substantially longer, yes. Yeah, definitely okay. Longer. I think the George stories was just slightly over 200. This is just a little under 500.
Oh, okay.
Yeah,
all right.
Yeah. So it's definitely a different kind of material for sure.
So you kind of got the writing bug, I would imagine, after publishing.
That's an understatement. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. That often happens when you especially when you put your first book out and you get good reviews, you just can't wait to dive into the next one. And like I say, right now I would be plugging into Terry's experience as a writer. She wrote her first novel, I think a year ago, a little more than a year ago, and she's already on her fourth. And they've been winning awards right and left.
That's impressive.
So she's been really doing really, really well. And she's coping with some personal problems in her family with her husband having an illness. So it's really, it's really tough on her, but it's amazing that she's been able to do all that she's doing, and she's so excited.
Sure.
So, again, Terry's not with us tonight, but it's great to hear Ryder get the bug. I mean, I can go months and months after someone tells me, after they read my book, which was Poppy's Prison. It was a fictional, historical fiction novel about my grandfather. And when they give me a good review, it's like, wow, this is great. I'm going to just keep going. And it means so much to hear the good reviews. We'll talk about reviews in a little bit, but
sure.
On to the next question here. Can you take us through the timeline of getting the George stories published? What was editing like? What was searching for a publisher like? And what was it like to finally have the book in hand and ready to put out into the world?
Yeah, so I had mentioned it took me roughly 10 years to write, and then it took me roughly 5 more years of submitting it before I found the publisher. So it was a long process, for sure. The actual book production was just slightly about a year and a half, all told, in terms of from the editing process right on down to actually giving me a physical copy of the book. But, yeah, it was, certainly a big change in my life. It was very gratifying. When you sit down and write, you don't always know how it's going to shake out. But it certainly has been extremely rewarding.
And you and Terry share the same publisher. I don't know if you knew that or not.
I did not know that.
Atmosphere Press is behind her.
Yes.
They
yep.
certainly are behind you. And can you talk about a little bit about them and how they helped you? I want to kind of focus more on the editing, because that can be a headache for a lot of writers. I mean, especially after you edit and then you send it to one of their editors and then they decide or kind of advise or whatever they do in what you're writing. They sometimes tell you, you got to chop this out or you got to add this. How was that like for you? Did you get a lot of feedback from them and any negatives or positives from that experience?
No, it was a very good experience. I worked with different people along the way in terms of there's a developmental editor, and then you eventually work with somebody else who does more of the line editing, that kind of a thing. All the people I worked with were very, very helpful. And they certainly gave me some freedom in terms of particular changes they had in mind. Some of my vocabulary can be a little out there in some respects. It sort of depends on people's backgrounds and that kind of thing. But so I did make some changes to simplify some of the vocabulary in some cases, but not in all. But overall, it was a good experience. I didn't have any major issues in that regard. There was one story in the George stories that wasn't quite right. I remember we actually moved the middle section of the story to the beginning, and then everything fell into place right after that. So that was kind of an eye-opener, and I certainly learned a ton from that particular experience.
And there was a advisor from Atmosphere Press telling you that you should maybe shift this a little bit?
Yes. It was one of the editors. Yes.
Oh, very good. Very good. And where did you find them and how was that? Did you have a lot of publishers to choose from? And what allowed you to choose them?
So I was very unfamiliar with the submission process back then, especially. So I did submit to a handful of agents, but I don't think I really had my act together in terms of the query letter and all that. But there's a website called submittable.com. I don't know if you've heard of it, but it's sort of a catch-all for submitting work to various independent publishers, and there's writing contests. and that kind of thing. So I just stumbled upon Atmosphere. It was one of the many that I submitted to, and then they reached out eventually. We got the ball rolling.
Very good. And what was it like, you know, emotional-wise for you when you got that copy in your hand and it was ready to go? That must have been a special time for you.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, it was definitely a big deal for me personally. One of the challenges I think I had with the first book was that I was largely writing almost in secret. It was okay. The kind of thing my family – yeah, no, I did. Like, it was one of those things where my family knew I wrote, but for whatever reason, I wasn't comfortable back then, like, telling people, hey, I'm writing this novel or that kind of thing. So when the book actually came out, it was kind of tricky to tell people, oh, I have this book coming out, because it was out of the clear blue, really. So
right, yeah,
kind of like me.
Yeah.
But it was certainly a tremendous feeling, and you know, you keep looking at the book, thinking, "Oh, is this actually real?" And it's definitely rewarding.
Great. And how did you feel when you gave a book to a friend or family member? Were you anxious about doing that, or did it just come natural and you didn't worry too much about it?
That's the one thing I didn't worry about it, really. I felt really good about the actual writing, the work, the story and all that. But it was just the initial telling people, oh, I have this book out. And they're like looking at you like, oh, geez, I didn't know you wrote.
Yeah.
But no, I always felt pretty good about the work in terms of that, that from that perspective.
Very good. And you touched on it earlier. You had mentioned a couple of your favorite authors. Who are some of your other favorite authors, and why them?
Well, that's kind of a long story. But years ago, the Modern Library came out with the top 100 novels of all time. I don't know if you remember that, but it was in all the newspapers, and there was a lot of discussion about what was included and what wasn't. So for whatever reason, I cut it out. I put it on my bulletin board, and I would just sort of, from time to time, check out various books on the list. And so I can't say I read all 100, but I'm certainly up in the upper register. But, certainly, Truman Capote back in the day, Salinger, Nabokov, Ross. A pretty large segment of American authors.
Great, great. So you're coming out with your second book soon. And
there's
different authors. They have different ideas of what success is for them. A lot of authors, well, I think probably when you start off, everybody wants to be a Stephen King. And then if you're not, you kind of feel let down or wherever. But that's kind of a high bar for a lot of first-time authors to shoot for. But in your definition, what is your success for you as a writer? What do you have to meet? What goals do you have to meet in order for you to feel that you've been successful?
For me, I think just having your work accepted, even if it's from a small lit magazine or a small publisher, that kind of thing, that's really the rewarding part, is just having your work accepted.
Okay, so you're not setting the bar too high for yourself, or not looking at making millions of dollars. You're
that would be wonderful for sure. That'd be great. I don't know if that's realistic or not. It's my particular stuff tends to be more literary fiction, so that's a smaller market anyway. It's not commercial fiction typically. So, and it's just hearing back from an editor, you know, we'll publish your work. That's a huge, huge thing for me.
Right. Yeah. Totally agree with you there. For me, as long as somebody likes it, then I've done my job. I'm not looking to make millions or anything like that. If it happens, it happens. Somebody had mentioned that they'd like to see my book made into a screenplay, and that's really a good standard, I think. If somebody says something like that, it's great. The next step would be actually trying to get it to become a screenplay, and that process is very long, and arduous, and I don't know if I'd want to put myself through that kind of anxiety and all those steps.
Right.
But it's nice to know that somebody cares enough that they said that it would happen. How do you deal with good and bad reviews? I haven't really looked to see how many reviews the George Stories has gotten, but how do you deal with that? What's your feelings on that?
Yeah, I think going back to being a part of creative writing classes, when you would share your particular story with a group, and sometimes it was well received, sometimes it wasn't, but you always come away learning something, and I think you definitely can gain knowledge and improve as a result, whether it's positive or negative. So different people like different styles of writing. So, I mean, there's certain authors that I just can't get into, but they're, well-known and very successful. So it's very subjective in that regard, I think.
Right. So I enjoy historical fiction, as I told you, and I became extremely absorbed in that genre with research. How much research, if any, did you do in writing the George Stories?
The George Stories, I don't think I did a ton, just because it was a pretty straightforward piece. I think I had to take a look at some of time period elements and in terms of what was part of the culture of the time and that kind of thing. But it was largely a modern day setting, so it wasn't that difficult. My follow-up, The Boys and Girls of America, it's 1990s, and there's a lot of pop culture references. So I did have to do more research in terms of that one, just to make sure everything lined up appropriately.
Do you enjoy doing the research?
Yeah, I think you can get sidetracked very easily, though.
Yeah.
I think I'm a pretty curious person, and you can easily find yourself, reading 6-7 articles when you only meant to read one. So there's good and bad to that part of it, really.
And I think, too, it can launch your story in another direction, too, if you find some good little chunks of gold out there when you're doing your research that you hadn't really thought about. And then that kind of just turns it, into gold for you, is adding to your story. And sometimes, of course, like you had said, that we get too engrossed in it, and we're spending hours researching and reading when we should be sitting down and working on our novel. But research is very interesting to me. I absolutely love research, and I'm glad that you're moving forward here in your next book. I'm really excited to read what you wrote. And
thank you.
Of course, we will get together at some point and probably discuss it further. But what do you enjoy most? I'll talk a little bit about electronic books and the real book, as they say. And what do you enjoy most, reading from an electronic book or a real book? And do you think bookstores will ever disappear?
I'm something of a book collector, so I go to old bookstores and I like the smell of them and all that. So I probably have more than I can actually put on a bookshelf these days. But I've never really been an ebook guy. I know they're certainly very convenient, and I know they're very popular. But for me, I've always liked the physical copy of books. In terms of down the road, I think probably everything could very well go down the digital path for sure. It might be a good long time before that happens, but it's probably inevitable.
I kind of like to look at it the same way as songs. Back when I grew up as a teenager, a young adult, we were, of course, into albums and cassette tapes after the albums came out. But I know that now a lot of people have gone back to the vinyl record. And I see books in the same way. I think that for a time, we may get away from the real book and kind of settle in on the electronic. I have to, as a reviewer, I can't buy regular books because I would have no room for them. And I read probably read and review about 100 books a year. so it would be very difficult for me to do that. So everything that I do is on my Kindle. But right. I really don't think bookstores are ever going to disappear, especially maybe the Barnes & Noble. But I kind of miss the old-time mom-and-pop bookstores. It, like you say, you walk in there and there's a sense of, you know, stepping back into time and, you know, the odor of the book, the smell of the book, the feel of the page and the binding and all that stuff. It just adds to the experience. And, of course, being a book collector, that's great. You must have a lot of bookshelves in your house.
I do, but I'm actually running out of space. So, yeah.
Yeah. And besides writing, what do you like to do?
I'm pretty big in the local tennis circuit locally here. I run some men's leagues. I'm pretty active in that, not just in the summer, but during the indoor season. So it's a big part of what I do. So it's kind of a family thing, too. My wife and daughter both play.
Oh, that's great. So do you, of course, you read a lot, too, I would imagine.
Yep.
Do you try to keep up with everything that's coming out, or how do you do that?
I've tried to read some more contemporary stuff of late just because for many years I read just old famous books and that kind of thing. So I've gotten into some nonfiction lately. So I read Chuck Klosterman's recent book. It's all about the 90s. It was a really good read.
And that helps you with your current book, right?
That was kind of part of that research angle, too, for sure. And then I just finished, it's called American Prometheus. It's about Robert Oppenheimer, the atomic bomb guy. So, it was a pretty compelling story. So I think I won the Pulitzer, but pretty good read for sure.
Do you find yourself being somewhat like George, the character that you developed? Is there any of you in George?
Probably some bits and pieces. I think people who read it, I think they tend to see things that may or may not be there. And, you know, sometimes people think, oh, I'm in the book or that kind of thing. But so much of what I do was just very spontaneous. And I just try to come up with good stories with interesting circumstances and interesting characters, but probably a little bit in bits and pieces. I think probably most authors fall into that category to some extent.
Yeah, I don't think as a writer you can sit down and write and keep yourself out of it. There's always, even on a subconscious level, if you're not consciously thinking about it, I think we write a lot of ourselves into our stories. And sometimes I like to dig into an author's stories and mm-hmm. listen to them talk if they're doing a live chat or whatever. Or, you know, nowadays you go to YouTube to get a lot of your content. But I think that that happens quite often. I know with Stephen King, that's one of my favorite authors. I think mm-hmm. he spends a lot of time probably in his own head, thinking about himself and his fears, and then, you know, transforming that or transferring that into some of his work. So I just find it very interesting when that happens. And it's really, you know, it's a gem when that happens and you start selling books and you can look at it. You even go back. Do you ever go back and read what you wrote? And do you sometimes think, you know, I actually wrote that, or you could have done better? Do you critique it at all?
I definitely critique. I think it's very easy to go back and look at your work and say, oh, I should have done this instead or that kind of thing. It's kind of a sickness, but I guess that's what makes you a writer if you do that.
Right, right. So anyway, Chris, we've got just a few minutes left here. Time certainly flies when you're having fun, and this is what we call our Oscar moment. Any parting words of advice or anyone you would like to thank for the successes you've had with the book or in life?
Oh, I think definitely my family. They've been very supportive over the years. So, yeah, just my family, basically. I've had some very good writing instructors along the way as well. So, yeah, but that's pretty much it. In terms of advice, I think probably most writers don't read enough. I think you have to really immerse yourself in a lot of books before you can really set your own mark as a writer.
And that's what I tend to say a lot, is you really have to read, read, read. And I think sometimes it becomes natural, I think, to the point where you don't even think about it. If you sit down and start writing, a lot of that stuff that you're reading will absorb and you just get it down on the page. It's like kind of like
sure.
riding a bike. You never stop realizing, or you never stop learning, or what I'm trying to say is you can get on a bike at any time of your life and continue riding. And I think that has a lot to do with reading too and writing. I think it's very important to read, read, read. So anyway, I love to have you on the show here. I'm glad you came. I wish Terry were here.
Thank you.
I know she'd love to talk to you, and especially that you're kind of co-authors with the same publishing company. And I know that Atmosphere Press has had a lot of authors on our show, and you know, kudos for them and getting your book out there. And they've been a really good fit for both you and Terry. So before we let you go, how can our listeners contact you, and of course readers too?
So I have a new website. It's authorchristophergould.com. It's up and running. My first book, The George Stories, is on there, and there's a picture of my upcoming book, Boys and Girls, up there as well. So, yeah, that's my website.
Very good. And thank you once again, Chris, and stay in touch, and you and I are going to have to sit down at some point and have a coffee together or whatever. I really enjoyed having you on the program.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Yep.
You too. Bye.
Bye-bye. And there goes Chris. And again, it's Christopher Gould, and he wrote The George Stories. So go to your favorite bookseller and look that book up. I'm sure you will not be disappointed. It was a great read, and I really can't wait till his next book comes out. And so anyway, Terry and I will be back in 2 weeks on April 17th, 2023, and author Suzette Lytle will be here with her book, Desert Phoenix. It's a sweeping love story and a harrowing account of the harshness of the American Old West. Desert Phoenix, the tale of a prostitute who gains an unlikely ally in her struggle for physical and emotional survival. And so until then, Terry and I will see you next on the Writer's Lounge, where we encourage writers and readers to keep the pen and the eyes to the page and to let the story begin. And so I would like to say, enjoy yourselves and be well and have a great night.
If they asked me, I could write a book about the way you walk and whisper and look. I could write a preface on how we met, so the world would never forget. And the simple secret of the plot, it's just to tell you that I love you a lot. Then the world discovers, as my book ends, how to make